794 Sorgan, August 15, 2009, Lecture 5.2, the final review, the first about corrections. All right, now, actually I did send you the final exam. It's take home, it's open book, it's supposed to take about 6 hours. I made a note on it that in that time I do expect you to produce some professional looking answers that like you would in real life to your boss or whoever requests something from you. I just talked yesterday, a student took this course 2 years ago and now works at the IMF, and she says she still has her folder. This is something. Look things up. So it's supposed to work in practice. So, with that, we'll first discuss some questions and then, to whatever time we have, we can go through what I call the topic-specific review, in which is sort of just an outline of everything we did in the course. So, whatever we don't get to here today, you can just sort of use for your own review. Since we don't do the exam tomorrow in class, the limit is just it's not quite as tight. So if you can do it tomorrow, fine. If you get it even by Wednesday, it will be okay.
Do we have course evaluations or anything to fill out?
That's an interesting question.
It's a small class, so sometimes they don't do it. But
I do not know whether they will put this up online. But if they do, will I send you an email? I would imagine.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Okay.
I just haven't seen anything with
so,
that.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Do we have it on Blackboard? I'm not going to check that to you. No, it's not a Blackboard. No, I don't. I still don't think that Blackboard is quite up for prime time, but I think the place I'm going, the students really expect have something there, so I'm going to have somebody work put things up there. But for my money, a reading you have on paper is still easier to process than a reading you have on Blackboard.
And there's actually an open source alternative called Moodle. It's much easier to use than Blackboard. So
oh, really?
I'm not quite sure why people keep it from, because Blackboard is pretty expensive.
I mean, I know of Moodle. I haven't really
Moodle,
looked at it.
Moodle.
Yeah.
Moodle.
So we could do an evaluation of the course supporting software.
It's probably the reason that most organizations don't go with open source, because you have somebody to pay and they have to fix it if it's broken.
It's huge in Brazil and other sort of developing countries where Blackboard is too expensive.
I see. Okay. So it may also be one of those cases that it's easier to use but not quite as powerful. And I'm just suspecting that, but I have no idea.
Blackboard's pretty powerful, but it's so hard to use that people very rarely actually use all the powerful capabilities.
Oh, really? So not even students use them?
No.
And it drives professors nuts, too. My husband has to use it for his job, and he hates it.
Okay.
You can actually do like virtual meetings and all that kind of video, all kinds of fancy stuff, but the interface hasn't really kept up, so it's very difficult to use.
Okay. What if you give, I mean, this is actually a pertinent discussion, what if you give the students good instructions on how to use it?
I used to work in the School of Public Policy, and we never used anything other than just the document sharing feature. And even that is not all that user-friendly.
Okay.
So there would probably have to be some training involved to get people to use all the other fancy stuff.
You'd have to convince the professors and give the professors appropriate support. I mean, there are quite a few universities that use Blackboard, where the Center for Teaching Excellence, or the equivalent, spends almost all their time teaching professors how to use Blackboard.
Oh, they're reclaiming here.
Yeah, but the professors still don't really like it.
Right.
I mean, I don't know about you. You're
I haven't used it.
I'm still much more technical savvy than probably 80% of the professors out there.
That could
at least.
Be. I mean, I went to one of the trainings some years ago, and I said, this is not ready for prime time. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're using frames and all sorts of old user interface technologies, whereas they do implement all these fancy technologies, but the interface is still the same old thing that they had probably 10 years ago.
I see.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, what I generally like to do in a case like this is to maybe do a training piece. It may take an hour, where the training material just says, do this, do this, do this, do this. So it takes them through the process. And whatever functionality you want them to use that's hard to see from the system, they will have done once and know how to do it. So the training is sort of, so if I were to decide that, well, the interface of Alpha 5 is not that great, but in my organization it may really be better than Access, I would do that sort of training. And the place where he got stuck, and people wouldn't get stuck because they would just follow step by step, and then they would know how to do it. So I imagine that something like this might ease the burden, at least on students, how to use the system. Yeah.
In response to that, part of an orientation very often is spent learning how to use Blackboard, and like I'll be taking an online course this fall, and one of the things we have to do is learn how to post a discussion item or stuff.
Right.
And that's one of the assignments within the first week.
Okay.
I guess one question for you is, how much training is needed to get somebody to really learn something? Because very often you show it to them once, but if they don't immediately use it afterward, or it's not something that they can immediately apply, it just doesn't stick.
But can you always go back to the... So you give them also, I mean, as part of that training, maybe you give them a one sheet with function keys, or... I mean, you give them... The training piece you do should be such that they could go back.
Okay.
And refresh their memory if they said, no, no. So how do you do this again? Here's step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Okay.
And the advantage of that is you may have certain things in mind that the users have to be able to do. And the program itself, the interface, may offer a bewildering array of things, and it's just hard for the users to find out what to select and what they should do. But you only want them to do this, and you want them to do it right. So you show them there how to do it.
So you have a combination of, you do training to make sure that they know that it exists and they have done it once, and then supplement that with documentation,
right,
or quick references,
right,
and make those available so that when they have to do it again, they can go back and look it up.
I mean, I give you another example. A student of mine did a dissertation on what is called sense making. So how people take notes and make sense, and they had two tools to use to write one group, with a group of children and students. I wrote an article on energy policy in the presidential campaign. They had Microsoft OneNote, which is actually not a bad system,
yeah,
to take notes and organize notes. What?
Yeah. I wish they would market that,
yeah,
more,
yeah,
especially for students, it's really fantastic.
It's not bad.
And the really good news is for the 2007 version, they'll make a free version of that available online.
Oh.
So, and that's kind of one of the features that I miss, because I'd like to be able to use that pretty much anywhere.
Oh, I
always
see.
Have those files on my desktop at home.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons I kind of stopped using
it. Oh, I see. Okay. That's useful. But anyway, so they use that tool. And they used a concept mapping tool where you can draw concepts and lines. And now you can actually the concept mapping tool lets you attach notes to your nodes. We had great difficulty with that problem, but we couldn't find out the terminology, so yeah, you just do it by exaggerated pronunciation. And those nodes could be either internal to the CMAP, or they could be URLs. And so it took us a little while to figure out that every node in CNode, in Microsoft Notes, actually is addressable through a URL. And so once we figured it out, it's very easy to actually link from CMAP to OneNote, which was essential for our purpose, so they could go for the concept map with their notes and write. If you were to do a usability study of that, you would say, this is terrible. But with the training, we just showed them how to do it, and they could easily do it. So all of these people went through a one-hour training, I think, of the combination of those two tools. Without that, it would have been very hard. With that, it was very easy. And I think I mentioned that early on, that you really need to look at use, at the ease of use, in terms of not just the program that comes out of the box, but what can you do within a classroom, within an organization, to do the training. And in that case, that was easy to do. And I guess I need to look at Blackboard. And since I am very sensitive to things, is people, the interface is not good, as you might have seen. So I will try to find, to make this for the student as easy as possible. And that might help that problem. Well, let's look at question one.
You're on page 133.
We're on page 133, final review. And we'll do, first we'll do my questions, then we'll do your questions, and then we'll, whatever time we have left, we will look at the outline. Actually, even in the outline, once we get there, we may still jump first to places that you think we should spend a little review on, because we cannot go through the whole course again. So let's do question one. I guess in the 60-minute version of that question, it would say discuss each of them briefly. In the 2-hour version, it would just say discuss each of them. So, what do you need to think about?
Thanks, staffing.
You need to think about who is going to do the software testing, the staff. Let's just get down what the components are and then discuss them. So who will do the testing?
The kind of hardware you're going to be in place, which should probably be similar to what they're using in the classroom.
Remember, it says this, including a software testing lab. The software testing lab is not the entire piece of the question. Nor does it say all the testing should be there.
You have a policy, if you're going to have any children involved in your testing, any students, you may need parental permission, you may need some kind of a, you may need to work out with the teachers' union if teachers will be using this, is their contract going to cover their time spent doing this?
So there is a teacher who probably has to ask, there's a question of if we do actual studies with users, who of users going to be, and how do we get the proper human subject permission and that aspect.
And you need to do some gap analysis to see what the needs are, opportunities for improvement.
So you need to do some requirements analysis.
You need to talk with the school district's IT folks and figure out what their computer facilities are like. Are they Microsoft throughout, or do they have mostly Apples?
You need to get a sense of the hardware installed in the schools.
You need to know the training facilities of and what are the training facilities available for the software
What do you mean by training facilities?
What's this, what are the support
facilities? What's the support for the software? That's the criterion. That's one criterion. But what do we need to do from the requirements analysis? A centerpiece of the whole business we haven't mentioned yet. Maybe it's too obvious to you, but don't think it's obvious. Just mention it anyway.
Budget?
No. To evaluate software, what do you need? What all of you did in your presentations.
You need to evaluate the needs.
Right, and that results in the end?
Narrowing it down to some packages and then evaluating them.
All of you did this. Yeah. The centerpiece of the whole business here is a checklist. Of criteria. Without that, none of the other things can happen. Okay.
Yes. It helps to actually read the question for me. For him.
And again, it doesn't say, it says including a software testing lab. But you're entirely right, in an exam, it's very important to read the question carefully. Twice. In real life, corresponds that in real life you're given a task to do. Understand the task before you solve it. So it's not, the exam is not just something out there in theory, it's actually simulating real life. So we need to, so let's look at these components here. We need to develop a checklist. And some of the theory will come out of the requirements. Well, what will the checklist include?
Generic criteria that you use across all the different software packages.
So there's a bunch of generic criteria. In a school district, even on the generic criteria, you need to watch out. What about sort of user interface criteria? Is it the same for all age students? So we have to adapt to age ranges. We have to adapt to handicaps. So there will be general criteria for software to support our students. That criteria has nothing to do with the subject necessarily, but it has to do with the way their student can interact with the the computer. So that's going to be a job right there. Are you going to develop this from scratch? I hope not. This certainly you can find literature on.
School does not have a large IT team to do
development. Well, this the IT team doesn't write the software. It is for acquiring software. But then, and I'm not even sure the IT people are necessarily the very best to do this checklist. And we could talk about how do we organize even that step, but. So the checklist has general criteria, which are taking into account in sections the ability of the students by age or by other criteria. So that's one piece. What's another piece of the checklist? Actually, even the general criteria you can further divide. So the general criteria that would be a lie independent from this education. Okay. Then we talked a little bit about educational software. And there may be general criteria that depend on education. What would go in there? When you do the requirements analysis, you find out what educational approaches are used in this system. And so for this question, of course, you need to think about sort of like a teacher, like an education. But again, I did talk about educational software. Remember sort of the different flavors or kinds of educational software, never mind the subject. So if you want to support language learning, what could you do?
There should be support for taking various sorts of tests from time to time.
So a general criterion at the education level would be, does this support assessing students' performance? One way or another, either by a formal test or by sort of otherwise monitoring the interaction. But a sort of general educational approach to learning a foreign language. They teach vocabulary. What would be approach to do that?
Just like different kinds of drills.
You could do a drill and practice program. You could do that in math. Drill and practice is an educational approach. So on our checklist would be, what is the educational approach? And then within those, how well it's implemented. And for drill and practice, there are certain criteria that apply independently from the subject. You could also do language with some sort of interaction, the talk, the answer, or I mean, somebody may ask you a question in Spanish, you're supposed to type the answer in. There are also approaches to do this, and each of them would have their evaluation criteria. Really, to do this, you would need to get into education. You know, the teachers may not be able to formulate those criteria, but you should be able to engage the teacher in a conversation to draw this out of them, knowing about usability criteria. Right, so we have very general, universal criteria. We have the criteria that apply across educational programs. And So, by the way, one of these, clearly one of the criteria is how does this keep the student's attention? But maybe the more important one, how does this engage the students intellectually? How does it engage their mind? Because in practice, may not fare very well on that one. But if you take an alphabetical approach, if you do this question and use the answers, it has to be, can be poorly done, it can be well done, and you can have some criteria for that piece. Alright, so now we have these two layers of criteria. But now these people want to use software for language learning, for math, for history, for English.
Include as a criterion support for different learning styles?
That would
maybe individualized?
That is a very good criterion to go on the second layer of general educational approach. From a general criteria for across education. Because supposedly one advantage of doing software is to be more responsive to individual students. So that's a good criteria at that level. If we have, we've got done with that level, what's the next thing to do? We now have to evaluate math software. Yeah, and then there will be specific criteria for each subject. And part of it is, I mean, part of the evaluation will be what is the content and how accurate is it. I don't know whether that might be true. Once one gets into it, one would find specific criteria applicable to math software, and then maybe even specific criteria applicable to software that tries to teach calculus. Or maybe a better way to put it is that tries to help students learn calculus. So we don't have just one checklist. We have sort of a bank of criteria from which we could draw a checklist for any particular type of software. So that's a checklist point. Okay. Now the other thing that was mentioned is probably actually, we actually didn't mention the component quite completely. We mentioned of this component only who are going to be the subjects. But that already assumes one approach to testing, the actual usability test. What we have to think about more broadly? Usability testing is one way to evaluate software.
Are you thinking like doing heuristics and stuff before the users get there?
Yes. But so we need to have a plan of the various evaluation methods we're going to use. Right? Once we have the criteria, we'll have to, for each piece of software we are looking at, we have to give scores for each criterion. How do we get these scores? So it's a general, in a large system like this, you're not going to stick with just one method. Right? So you want to have an overall plan that combines a number of methods. And so we have to say, and that also has some sequence. And at that point, you could just write down what you have in your, what you're in your project, essentially. Because you went so... actually, there's one piece we didn't talk about that we come first. How do we know what software there is in the first place? So you have to plan to search for software. And the answer, if you have 2 hours, you would talk a little bit, maybe not for half an hour, but for 10 minutes, how you would go about identifying software. How would you?
You go on the internet and basically go to the various portals like we use Tabasco and try to find literature about the type of software support required.
So one thing is to find literature on educational software,
yeah.
And there may be journals about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'd start with doing a phone call or a quick survey of all the department chairs at the schools and saying, okay, what software does the music department use? What does the science department use? And hopefully they can have an idea of what's being used in there.
So you could find out what are they using now. That's one input. Looking on the web, doing a search for literature would be another input. Surely must be websites that are essentially a catalog of educational software. Another way of using the web to find things. There are companies that specialize in producing educational software. So you could look from there. So these are all resources from which you would find software.
You could also look out for, you could check some other educational institute and check to see what they are using.
Okay, could do that.
Because that would be information which is not a proprietary sort of software.
Right.
It's available.
Alright, so we have criteria, we have software. Now, how do we get to the, for each piece of software, to get a checklist filled in.
To sort of identify a team of evaluators?
That's going into staff, but so we're just looking at generic methods. So what did you do in your project? What's the first thing you did?
I did online research to see if I could answer the criteria.
Look for reviews.
Right.
If you find comparative reviews, the much the better. The there needs to be some step of screening before you even look at reviews. And some of these sites have, I mean, if you go to this, to one of these portals that do have an inventory of education software, they may have short descriptions, and it may take a little experience, but often you can just tell them the short description, this is not for the school system. Well, that is, I mean, as we know, there's a lot of bad software out there, and often you can tell from a short description. Or they may have a sample screen displayed, but often you can sort of, in 5 minutes, tell. No. Okay. So for the ones that pass that first screening step, then you go and say what people say about them. So where would you look for that?
Actually go and check their websites, vendor websites, to have more of an idea.
That could tell you something. Reviews. Where else do you find opinions these days?
Blogs.
Blogs, wikis. I guess you would need to do a search for that type of software. You may have found out that it's sometimes hard to find reviews or even opinions because I guess there's not really a good web source to search for opinions. Because you can't put in the software name and opinion.
Yeah, the worst thing to do is to type in a product name and type review, because you go get to all these fake review websites that somehow have optimized their content for Google searches and stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to limit your search to opinion sites?
Supposedly the Microsoft Bing search engine, they have a sort of a specialized version for product reviews.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how mature yet.
Yeah. But you would want to limit your search to blogs.
Yeah.
And there are tools.
Wikis and sites like Opinion for Amazon, but I don't know whether anybody has a list. Or it would be nice to have a your web source to say I want only the kind of sites that give opinions.
And for consumer technologies, you can go to like CNET or Yahoo Technology, something like that, and they will aggregate reviews from different sort of respected sources.
Oh, okay. So if there's something like that available, in any way, you would try to get what do other people say about this software.
Because when I search Amazon reviews, it immediately draws up the reviews of products on Amazon.
Oh, yeah. That's clearly impossible. Having a specific software name and saying review, that may get you a lot of bad stuff, but it may get you some good stuff.
Doing something like you expect it to be covered in the review, like, you know, the application name and usability,
right,
or the application name and some other...
That might be user friendliness or...
Yeah.
Something like that might... So anyway, so we do that, we read that, we do a preliminary filling in of the checklist, and that's the second cut. So now we are at the third cut of those we want to examine in more depth. And so the answer would describe those steps. Where do we go? What do we do? We may eliminate more on the way, but what would be the next tool or arsenal of tools to evaluate software? We clearly do this by increasing effort. Okay, looking at the one paragraph is really an effort. Finding reviews, some more effort. Okay, what's the next tool by next level of effort?
Actually, a request for demo versions of these shortlisted.
For the next step, you probably would need a demo version. And what will you do with it?
Then you identify user categories at various levels and try to do focus group studies on those demo versions.
Focus group studies are very expensive. What do we do before that?
You could do just basic heuristic tests.
Heuristic evaluation.
And eliminate some more probably.
And yes. And so this goes to question 3, where this is discussed in more detail, what heuristics to use. But it's just what Niels would call the discount usability evaluation. So that would be a tool, or often that would be apply next. And we may eliminate some more after that. But at that point, remember that we will always keep in mind from this step on, whatever. I mean, if this is really great on content, but it doesn't pass those muster by usability, what could we correct for that? We discussed before.
How big your school district is and how responsive the vendor is.
Right. We may not be able to change the software. We may just be able to do our own instructions with it. So it's usable. So at this step of evaluation, you would also need to evaluate the content. So what staff is involved in that evaluation that still doesn't involve any users? For the usability part, we need a usability expert. So presumably we need to make sure that in this school system at least one person knows about usability principles. What about the content part? Who is able to check the content part?
Probably some QA experts, quality experts.
Or the teachers.
Or the teachers. The subject content of the educational software provides the means for learning, and so they need to ask questions that get students to think, or they need to present content the student can read or otherwise engage in. And so you need to look, and so the teacher has to walk through the software from that perspective. And we might organize it so that the usability expert and the teacher do the walkthrough together. The teacher might identify usability problems also. The teacher knows the student. Except the teacher may identify just problems, and they may not be attuned to how could this be better. The people are very easily satisfied with bad software. Otherwise, it wouldn't be so much bad software. So the usability expert's job then would be to say, well, this is really not done well. This could be done, or maybe it's done well, but it still could be done better.
And it's not your fault for not knowing how to use the software.
Yes.
That's a big deal. But
it's still an expert walkthrough. It doesn't have users yet. But actually, all the various techniques that we discussed in the web usability lectures, they apply to software class as well. All right, so what's the next tool in our arsenal after we apply this walkthrough technique with both usability experts and content experts?
It might be good to check the hardware support or the and underlying infrastructure to be used, because it requires a lot of changes to the existing structure. It might not be worth it to go going any further and doing it on the usability.
Right. Actually, come to think of it, you might want to do that first. So that's easy to do. And you would, at that point, need to sort of set a cost figure that you may need some accommodation to your hardware. But you may need that anyway, and so the cost may be modest. And if some software really has the potential of getting the math scores of your students up by 20%, and particularly get the minority students interested in learning and more engaged in the schoolwork than they are often all, because they don't have the kind of parental support that other people have often, then it may be worth the cost. But if it's twice the budget of the school district altogether, then you couldn't do it. So you sort of set a limit above which it's not worth pursuing this further. And below that, you will still pursue it further. Okay, so then we do this walkthrough that we just discussed. And then what? Actually, the result may be this is good. Let's deploy it. Maybe a little risky, but what would it depend on whether you say this is really good and let's deploy it?
Whether the students like it or not.
Well, but Let's do it the other way around. Let's do the one first. So let's say we're not going to be that risky. What's our next step then before we actually deploy it in the school system? The final tool in the arsenal of evaluating the software. You've been talking about it already. Actual testing with users. There are levels of that even. When you just bring in 1, 2, 3 students and observe them, which might get you some more insight. But if the proof of the pudding is if you deploy this in some classroom and see how much students learn, that's the ultimate proof, right? And we'll have to discuss how to select the classrooms, what teachers are really capable of deploying the software properly in their classroom. Because you may need to, in the actual, that maybe goes beyond the question, but in the actual deployment of the software, you need to train teachers to use it. So you need to find a teacher now who could use it and then test it. When give the teacher a list of criteria, a part of it, a version of the checklist that has those things that the teacher reasonably can fill in. Maybe not everything, because many of the criteria we can determine otherwise. How does the software testing lab come into this all? All of this. Which of these steps is done in the software testing lab? Or which of the steps all done, I should say.
Definitely the testing with future users.
We might have a classroom lab, in which case you could even do the classroom testing in it. But whether that would be as genuine as doing it in the actual classroom is another question. If the school buildings all have computer labs where such classes are held, you would hold it there. But you won't want to do the real testing in the real environment. So the software testing lab would be used. Well, where are you going to do the walkthroughs? What if you have to test this? Actually, is it good enough to test this on one machine in one configuration? You have to test it on various different configurations. So the software testing, I presume, will have that. Okay. So the walkthroughs, and then if you bring in just individual students, then need a software testing lab. Because presumably, so how would we equip this? We would have different kinds of machines. What else?
I also want to have some way to monitor the users with cameras or single-sided mirrors or whatever that's.
Well, the thing about mirrors, you observe them, but that may be useful. But the monitoring uses, so cameras, what else? Is it simpler than a camera?
Recording what they're doing on the screen.
You need a logging facility. So at a minimum, a keystroke logging facility. But even better, to capture the scene. As they're doing it, so you can replay what they did. That would go in the testing lab. So what do we do at the end? We collect a lot of data.
It would help to have some kind of a standard template for summarizing the results of each evaluation step.
Yes. And then being able to put it all together. You really have to have a template for teachers, where they fill in. And we'll have to have some system that manages collecting all this data for each piece of software we are testing. Because each piece of software will, as the testing moves on, more and more information will be collected. Any other comments on question one?
Well, a version control system for your software, and having a software collection or something like that.
Right. Now, this question is clearly related to, but it doesn't ask you about discussing how to organize a software collection in the school. If that was part of it, you'd have to have a software catalog there, and there you would have to keep track of whether new version of the software appears. Then you'd have to keep track problems whether the software still works when the operating system changes and everybody changes over from Windows XP to Vista. Does it still work? And so on. Okay, let's look at question two, which takes more a designer's point of view. As by the way, for both question one or question two, you could substitute website for software and have the same answer. Well, actually, in a way, today you would look at it as one space. Because if you want to find something that teaches children whatever history, it could be a piece of software you deploy in your machines, or it could be a website that students access. And the two would compete with each other. Sense of where you should put your students' time to. Either one may support students' learning. Okay, so what's your plan for question two? So I tell my students in information structure course, for the answer for almost every question in this course, a good beginning is start looking at user requirements.
For that, you would also like to know who is your target audience.
Right. So that would be part of. So, target audience. What function of the target audience is the software intended to support? What do the people do?
Or before that, if you're involved in the entire process of development, make sure usability is part of the budget. Make sure testing is part of the budget.
Oh, yes. Yes.
It seems very commonsensical. The large project that I'm on did not originally include any funding for testing.
Okay.
At all.
Okay. Now, since you are a usability consultant and they want to be involved in the entire development process, you would assume that they are enlightened.
I assume that they find in some way to pay my salary, but that may be,
Yes. So the plan would include for each step what it would cost. We may have alternatives on how to do each step and discuss how much it costs. So first we look at requirements and look at the functions this software is going to actually look at not at the functions of software necessarily, but of what do people do? What is their task? What do they want to accomplish? And then we can say, how will software support that goal? Then we talk about functions of software. Okay, so that would be the basis for doing something that will fulfill its purpose.
And also understand the background of the user community, maybe
yes.
Create some personas. Are they teenagers? Are they seniors? Are they people who have been doing this job for 10 years already?
Right. Right. And you might want to find out what makes them tick.
And you may also want to find out whether the product is a very new, innovative product which for which there is no sort of a competitor existing, which might mean that you might have to devise more budget to training the users because they are not familiar with that type of a software.
Yes, or you make sure you do it in such a way that it's not doesn't require that training.
Yes.
But and of course for this kind of new kind of software may, if it addresses a widespread need, may be the one that's most profitable in the end. If you really, but somebody may have had a really good idea based on their intuitive understanding of what users might need. Or they may have a really good idea of what users don't, tasks that users don't even do know. No. But that if you give it to them, they would like to do. I mean, who would have believed 10 years ago that people would actually pay money for virtual objects in Second Life? I still don't understand why they do it, but they do it. So that goes with why people tick. So, but you would need to somehow, unless you want to take it, I mean, somebody may just say, I'm too innovative and this will work and I'm taking the risk and I'm willing to put my money in, or I'm going to convince 10 investors to put their money in and they may lose the money. But in the more prudent approach, you would find out first what makes users tick. So you have some idea of what needs to support it. What's your idea how software could support this? And so that's sort of the germ of the idea of the new product. Then what do you do to involve users?
prototypes? Or are we not there yet?
It could be prototypes, but you do some kind of, what is the term they use when users are involved in the design?
You would typically go identify the users and do a market survey sort of thing of what are the features that users are looking out for.
That. A market survey, what users are looking for, might not be very useful because users have no idea what they're looking for. They have tasks they're doing. And if somebody gives them something to support that task, they'll be happy, but they may not have envisioned how that could be done. I don't say don't ask users, I just, the survey won't do that. The term that's used is participatory design. So you don't make users designers, but you involve them in the design process. So this could take various forms, and maybe forms over time. So you have this generic idea, what could you do to get some more insight on what would actually help users and what could they do, what could they deal with? By the way, I have no idea whether Facebook people did any such study. You can have a good idea and just do it. It may work, but for every one of those that actually worked, there were probably five that didn't.
Or many, many, many more.
Or many, many more that didn't. So if we want to do this more prudently, if we want to find out. Our analysis so far just has been from intuition, from maybe reading about this task, from, we haven't talked to any users yet. So what's our next step? Prototype is one piece of, if we had a prototype, then what would we do?
Are we still not involving any users?
We are now in the.
We are.
Okay. We are the step of involving users. Yes.
Okay.
Before that, I might also want to have some training sessions with the developers, where we're just going to go over some best practices and maybe some guiding principles and that sort of thing.
That certainly has a good piece of your plan. But I'm not sure we are there yet, because we don't have enough information yet to train the developers.
You would probably look out for competitors again.
Yeah.
If it's an existing idea, you could look for ideas from competitors.
And try to see what the critics or the reviewers point out to.
You could collect this kind of information even before you talk to users. Okay. But now we are at the step where we want to take all this and move forward, and how do we involve, how do we benefit from involving the users in the next step? So the prototype may be one step ahead, but anyway, once we have a prototype, what do we do?
Oops. I was going to suggest before we do prototype, we make an effort to solicit users to start. Maybe whoever is sponsoring the project can recommend some people, or help identify some users to talk to.
Okay, but what would we do in talking to the users? How would we organize this piece?
They called workshops.
You have a focus group. What would you do in this focus group?
I know with us, I do mainly requirements, so it's almost like therapy. Tell me where your current business processes are. Tell me where they're hurting you. Tell me where we might be able to help you. And it's somewhat like psychotherapy, and it's kind of interviewing, it's listening, it's understanding their needs and their processes.
So this could be done through a focus group.
Mm-hmm.
What's worse?
Or individual interviews.
Depending on how much money you have, what's the individual interviews, focus groups. Now, you can just go to that stop, to that step, but you... if you have some idea already how you might help these users.
You show them a prototype and say, hey, does this look good?
You show them something. It could be a prototype, but it could just be a screen mock-up. Or it could just be something on paper. Or it could be an exercise where the users themselves can suggest designs and say, is this a good color for that to indicate this function? Is this a good icon? Is this a good place? Where would you put it? So I think sometimes they even have users who cut and paste, and they just give them, and they sort of put a, so they give them some art and graph material, and the users put together a prototype screen. Now, whether that's a good one or not is another question, but you can still draw something from it. Yeah?
And you could also, you can do that with several different, and when I say prototype, I'm meaning either paper prototypes or wireframes,
right,
or dummy data, or, you know, it doesn't have to be software, it can be just even drawing on a board.
Right.
But it helps to have several different approaches, and it's much easier for the users to say, yes, I like that about that one, but I don't like that about that one, and this other one does that particular thing much better.
Right.
And to kind of give them different ways of looking at something, rather than saying, here is one way we've developed, how do you like it?
Right.
Because they are more apt to not want to hurt your feelings or overlook the fact that, gee, there are multiple ways to do this. Which one might be better for them?
Right.
Seems like it would very often be pretty difficult to come up with like a coherent summary of all these different opinions, though. I don't know how frequently people are going to come up with very similar designs.
You just collect ideas.
Right.
Another technique you could use after you show them something, because you probably have to show them something to get their idea flowing, you could say, let's take half an hour and everybody types into their computer ideas they have. These are reactions to what they are, or functions that they would need to see added. Because if you ask you what should the software do, they may not be able to tell you things, but if you show them some thing, they will then think, but this is missing. They will then have some idea of that software could help them. I still remember this, I told you this, we had a faculty kind of idea. It was 30 years ago. Or, I'm almost 30 years ago. She wanted to study how people and computer systems work together. And she wanted to, she saw that she, I don't know what connection they had, but there was this poison control center that worked with all paper records. And so she went there and said, would you let me develop a computer system for you that you could test for me and I could observe how you use it? And said, no, we are perfectly happy with our system, we have not go away. And somehow she said, oh, please, but I need to do this for my dissertation. So she developed some rudimentary system and said, this is it, and they used it, and said, it's all very nice, but why doesn't the system do B, C, D, E, and F for us also? So what they started using is they had ideas how it could be more useful. And in this participatory design, once you show them the prototypes with some function you thought of, users may well come up with more. And it will be chaotic. And so you have to provide in your plan for somebody who looks at all these various inputs and makes new designs and then runs those with the users again, the same or different.
One technique that my company uses is we have what we call a parking lot, which is a way to capture users' good ideas, regardless of merit, but it's a way of showing that you're listening to them and not losing track of something that they suggest, even if it's completely unfeasible right now or nobody else would need it. It helps on a personal level because they're more likely to give you additional information, but also that can be a rich source of ideas for future versions.
Right. I mean, and you really have to prioritize some things, and so this is the user involvement in the initial stage of the design. Then what happens in the process of software development? We have an initial design, so now what do we do?
Actually, ask the development team to develop the initial version,
start with the initial version
of the software, and set timelines and all those project management parameters in place.
As a usability consultant, you don't really have the force to say you shall observe good project management. But what you can do is point out the need for controlled releases and versions, and having that go to testing immediately and providing that as part of the process.
So your plan would be developing, and it could be component testing. Is that different functionalities, or it could be what the first develop may still be sort of a prototype, but now the first ones may not have been functional prototypes, just sort of show. Then develop something that actually works, and you would still bring in users to work with it and get feedback. And you, at every stage of development, you could do that, but you would need a system of bug reports. So the testing might identify bugs, but also usability, that may be not even your main responsibility, but you would still say so, and you would do note usability problems all the way along, and have most software teams have a bug reporting system. So a meant is to also report usability problems. And by the way, we needed to pick up a point he made. Once we have this initial design and all this input from the users and also have input what users have difficulty with, then we need to have a training of the developers. If they are not very good in usability to begin with, the training in usability principles. But the developers need to have internalized usability heuristics so that everything they design, they need to test against usability heuristics there, so we don't have these problems later. But there will still be problems later, so it's that general training, but also specific training for this particular application. Users put value on this, and users, that this is what makes users tick, so we have to include it. Then they develop. And then we test with consecutive versions. And of course, before we test it with users, we need to make sure it's actually that's what it's supposed to do.
Another factor is many a times when developers develop a piece of software that goes for alpha testing and various other types of testing, QA, and then when it goes for user acceptance testing, at that time there might be modifications again based on how the users feel the software works, and there might be bug fixes reported back to the development and so on. But at some stage, developers need to fix on the requirements. Additional features would be probably released after this version is released, as a second version of the software. So that's a very tricky decision which the management needs to make, where they need to fix the requirements and fix the design specs, so that the version is at least released, the first version.
There are two kinds of problems. One is sort of the generic interface problem with this piece of software, and does this work well for the users? Of course, we assume that the way we did this, its basic functionality, is comfortable. And the alpha testing phase just has individual users brought in, or maybe sometimes even a focus group brought in to three of them try it and they talk about it, which is to ensure that when it goes out for beta test, the generic interface is good, and that a lot of the feedback may be on functionality people want to have added. Then you do have to decide whether this is so important, and how do you find out? If you follow the process we just described, the manager of the project should understand the task of the user very well. And so the manager should have an idea of whether this functionality would be used by 80% of the users or only by 2%. And so if some of the beta testers have a very bright idea that would make this product quite as useful, you may want to act on it. Now, if it's something that would be useful for only 5 people, you put it on the stack of things to be done later. But you're right, that's something that management has to decide. The danger is to want to include everything in the first version, and you can't, or you will never release. Yeah.
If you had a requirements analyst on the project, also had the requirements analyst test software against the requirements.
Oh yes, absolutely yes. No,
yeah.
The testing against requirements cannot be left to the developers. It has to be done by a requirements analyst first, and by users second. Now, at the very end, we may want to do some. I mean, all of this so far has been formative evaluation. At the very end, we may want to do some, it's called summative evaluation, I mean, some measurements, how long does it take to do these tasks with this software. You may even, I don't know whether any software company ever did this, you know, a food company will contract with an independent laboratory to do the analysis of their product, and then they will use the results in the advertising. So if you had your software tested by some independent lab, and then you can use the results in your advertising. Actually, I think they do this. They do make beta versions available to PC Magazine. And I don't know what kind of feedback they get. But that's another, towards the end, just pre-release, there may be sort of some testing in real life, and where it's the emphasis is more on how well does this work than on, you might still find some places to fix, but it's how well do we stack up against competitors and be able to make some claims how well this works. So that's sort of the life cycle, and users were involved at every step. step of this, yes.
It also helps to know the training plan or be able to advise it.
Which plan?
Training.
Training, okay.
And the other reason for that is it's very, very common for developers to say, well, once the users get training, they'll know how to do that. And a lot of usability problems stem from that notion that, well, we'll just train the users and then they'll know. It's not intuitive, but once they see it, they'll know. Sometimes that's even true.
I think that's a good point to include this. Now, if we can make it intuitive, then we should really make it intuitive. But not the function itself may change the way people do the task for the better. But it still requires training. So nobody would think about letting somebody drive a car without some training. Okay, because I mean, even if you had asked you 100 years ago, how can we, so you find that it's possible to go from here to there, would any of them have rejected a call? Probably not. Once someone developed a car, was the car within the experience of his users? Was it intuitive? No. So if the software provides an entirely different but better way of doing the task, you have to have training. And it is sort of a co-development, if you will, of users and software. And that kind of training you cannot avoid. Just poor interfaces that require training, that's a different matter. So if you would need training to use next year's model of a call, that would be poor design. The call that's released now should be, well, unless somebody came up with a way to better steer a car, I don't know what it would be. But if somebody came up with a way to better steer a car than the steering wheel, and this could be shown to really be much more efficient and safer, then we say it's worthwhile to be training. But to put the control of the wipers on the left side of the steering wheel and the control of the light on the right, that would be stupid. Right? Because everybody else does it the other way around. Just like putting a navigation pen in the left on the right today, well, it would be stupid because people are used to it in the left, and there's no, that's a very good reason to otherwise. It's not good. So some things you can design intuitively. Using an icon that will immediately suggest what it means is clearly better than having to tease the user that butterfly means this. So I think that's where that goes. Whatever you can design through interface in such an intuitive way that it does not require training, then do it. But if it cannot be done, then do the training. And you may be able to design a cumbersome process intuitively, and the simple process requires training. Well, if this is going to be used by a lot of people in their daily work, the training is worth it. If this is used by people on a walk-up kiosk in a mall, you don't have an opportunity to train. But to rule out training completely is not a good idea. I mean, to say everything has to be usable by people as they walk up to it, that ignores, I mean, if by this principle you would not have cows today, or that probably some type of software wouldn't have today. when WorkBuzz initially came up, people had to be trained not to press enter at the end of a line. Okay, so some things do require training. You have to look at both sides. What you're designing in the end is a system that consists of a user and the computer has power with that particular piece of software. And that system needs to be optimized. And that needs, that may need work on both components. Let's take a break and reconvene at 4:10, which is a 15-minute break, and I suggest what we do is get into your questions, get into, and maybe you want to look at this overall outline and see whether there are some parts where you want to get a little more discussion of, and you may come back to questions 3 and 4. End of this lecture.
So just